You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Around the Block. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Susan Giddings.
Hey there.
Welcome to another show. Yes. Well, it's just been a busy week, as everybody can imagine, and I went up on our Facebook page to post a question. So we have a couple of our subscribers' questions. So you want to go first? You want me to take one of the RDAP ones?
Well, why don't you take one of the RDAP ones? Because there was a question about the different phases of RDAP and not the TDAT or the community treatment section, I noticed.
So this last one, my loved one is currently in RDAP. They've cut visiting. He has been seeing other people go to halfway house before they thought they would. Could someone in RDAP leave mid-program for halfway house due to space and these issues? And the answer is 99% no. You have to finish the institution-based portion of RDAP first before you can go and take the community-based portion of RDAP while you're in RRC or home confinement. So sadly, if you're in the middle of your institution curriculum, you can't leave early, despite what they hear or they see with other people. They're pretty strict with that in RDAP, you know. Well, so,
and we just had a client who thought that they would be better off by dropping out of RDAP and to get halfway house. And what they were counting on was the time credits plus all of the Second Chance Act time. And right. when they gave up RDAP and they lost the RDAP time, they are actually sitting in prison longer. Right. A combination of both the halfway house issue, but the loss of time. And you know, as we talked about in last week's show, in almost every scenario, you do better by staying in RDAP and finishing the RDAP and getting the time off, even with shorter sentences.
Oh, right. Yeah. So, yeah, you have to finish the institution piece first before you can go to. Now, there's been exceptions over the years. I remember Brian had a compressed 6-month program, other, you know, but there's exceptions, but ordinarily, no, you got to finish it.
But that wasn't incomplete. They actually did a compressed program. So you
right,
still
right.
got 100% of the program. They just were able to complete
That's
it.
True. That's true. They correct. So.
Okay. So we had another question about a person's, their recidivism level dropped too low on the 12th of the month. Congratulations. That's a very big deal, dropping from the upper range and the medium and high down into low, and wanted to know how quickly the FSA credit would be applied. It is applied with the next posting of credit.
Right.
Each month that the credit is applied or the application is run, it's checking all of those factors. It's checking risk level, it's checking eligibility. So it's not happening in real time. It's happening when those individual updates are. I'm going to apologize. Somebody just sent something to my printer and it's printing.
Right.
We'll deal with that later.
It's just in.
Just in, yes.
It's just in off the press.
And then it jammed, so we're doing great. Anyway, so yeah, so come the end of the month, the next update, should a mid-month update occur? That we're seeing in some of those select cases, it could be applied mid-month, but as kind of a routine expectation, end of the month when the monthly update runs. Also, go ahead.
I was going to say, no. And that's what's so frustrating, right? The person has theoretically earned the FSA, but they haven't got it applied because they haven't pushed the button yet. And that's frustrating. Hopefully that'll get better with time.
Well, And speaking of how that gets better with time, is one of the problems is the complexity of the law has required an application that is incredibly complex. And because of that, it takes so long for the application to run, to go through the entire population. It takes more than 24 hours because of the multiple data sets, data points that it has to check, coupled with the 158,000, whatever number the population's at right now. It checks everyone, whether they're eligible or not, because something could have changed from the previous month. So,
That's true.
So another question was asked on the issue of halfway house and FTCs. Had a concern that the institution was doing their own thing. And the question was, as legal residents that can't go to halfway house, so are there any other options for them to get halfway house after earning FSA? So if we recall from a couple shows back, and we talked about the difference between FSA, halfway house, and second chance at halfway house. Don't have the specifics, but I'm willing to bet this is a person that is getting time credits toward early release and not getting any time credits toward halfway house, which means they are exclusively a Second Chance Act placement. And as you know, we've talked about several times, the agency is having to prioritize those FSA halfway house placements over the Second Chance Act placements. And the reality is we are seeing people get shorter halfway house placements. We've had some get none at all. And it's because they're prioritizing those FSA placements first. They're getting the beds.
Now,
so the answer is no. If they have been denied bed space, if they've been denied a halfway house placement by the regional reentry folks, excuse me, under the Second Chance Act, it's because they don't have the capacity. That's where they're at. And it could be a reduced capacity issue because of staffing at the halfway house. There's different factors that play into it, but it is what it is.
Now, I'm hoping that there wasn't a typo. So I'm going to read it, this question, in case she meant illegal residents. Okay.
That was the one I just was addressing.
Right.
If they were illegal residents.
Right. But well, let's just broach this on the illegal or the alien side.
Or non-U.S. citizens, yes.
All right. So somebody's doing their time. They're earning First Step Act credit. And they have a First Step Act release date. But they're not a U.S. citizen. And they haven't had a hearing. What happens next?
They can apply their credits toward early release to shorten their sentence and be turned over to immigration officials to resolve their immigration status. But they are not being placed in halfway house now as of the new administration.
Unless they've gone to a hearing and declared
and been determined to not be deported. If their deportation status is unresolved, meaning they haven't, an immigration court hasn't ruled one way or the other, they are currently not being placed. And that is as of the new administration.
Yeah. So. And I know that's another frustrating thing because you're earning something and then you're taken away. Or if ICE takes the individual out of a BOP facility, they might even lose that year, right? Have to go.
No. The only time they don't get any time credits is if ICE has determined that they will be deported. If they are in a undetermined status, they're getting those time credits toward release, early release. Now, new status, new administration, they are not being placed in home confinement. Or, I'm sorry, in any pre-release.
Right. Okay. So, what's the next one?
Last phase question two and a half with the FTC time and the RDAP time.
Okay.
So, when we talked about this last week, and it was a whole lot of numbers and a whole lot of math, so that was painful. But always remember, the RDAP time is applied first. So that time off is applied first. And in order to get that time off, you have to complete the program at the institution and complete the 4 months in Halfway House. So they adjust the time credits. So again, the way the law is written, right, is time credits can be applied toward early transfer to supervised release or and or early Halfway House placement. So if they have to shift those to the Halfway House side, so you get your 4 months, it will adjust, they will adjust the time credits. They will apply, because what ends up happening is if you can't get the full 4 months in Halfway House, you lose the full year off or the full 9 months off on the RTAP.
As a 628 thing, but has that been automated now, or is that still kind of old?
No, it's still a manual operation. So when the individual gets their Halfway House date, then the unit team submits an updated 628, and it's the only three pieces of information on a 628, right? And that's just the form number. But the only three pieces of information is, this is the date the person completed RDAP at the institution, this is the date they're transferring, and this is the number of days they need to be in the Halfway House. And that's it. So for, let's say, person completes RDAP, is scheduled to complete RDAP on June 15th, and the case manager does the paperwork for an immediate transfer, because the time between completion of RDAP and the conditional release date is 9 months. Right. So that's right. Inside the 12 months of SCA time. So it's totally within the scope of the law. Right. So right. They submit them for an immediate transfer. RRM gets the paperwork. The RRM has to give them at least 4 months. RRM can give them up to the 9 months that was recommended. RRM doesn't have the 9 months to give him and gives him a 7 month placement or an 8 month placement. Totally within the acceptable scope of the law, totally within the discretion of the Bureau to make that determination. They have to have at least the 4 months. So then you're sitting there in the institution for an extra month or 2 months or 3 months, whatever it comes out to. Mm-hmm. But RDAP always applied first.
Okay. Yeah. And that's, and we've, and, you remember while you were still working, we had some of those 628 issues, right, that we were able to help folks get cleared up. And
we had a lot when for the folks that were out on CARES Act and went out before the rollout of the credit, which there was a lot of them, some of their 628s said they had 2,000 days of Halfway House.
Right.
And, of course, once the credit rolled out and – they applied all this, they applied the credit, that 628 locked their release date. So without, and that the manual operation was literally created decades ago, and it was to prevent an erroneous release for an individual that didn't complete at least the 4 months. It was a safeguard. It was a fail safe, and it couldn't be overrode by an accidental keying in the computer. There had to be a new form done.
What we would do, we would run rosters, and I'd look at people that were DAP part 30 to 45 days away from the end of their sentence. We'd do this other authorization saying that they were still finishing up their transitional service or TDAT or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then they could go ahead and roll out.
Right.
Once that date hit, but we had to go there and kind of pre-certify every person in the region that was coming toward the end of their transitional service period. So,
and that's what they're having to do now still, except they're having to submit a new 628. And so they're literally looking at their calendars and calendaring these guys and saying, okay, when the credit in September posts, I've got to go ahead and do a new 628. So, because what happens is for these guys now, because we do have the conditional calculators, we have all these new tools, what's happening now is at the point that the unit team does the paperwork and submits the information, it's again, it locks everything up. So the person continues to get their time credits and it's reflected, but then it flips and says, oh, wait, no, the rest of the time credits is now going toward Halfway House. And that's fine if they've hit 365 days. But right. Let's say they're at 210 days. And now it's saying, well, you have 210 days toward early release and 15 days toward Halfway House. But you're already in Halfway House.
Which are there, yes.
But it's because that 628 has froze everything. So then what the folks in the community treatments branch are having to do is calendar all these guys, wait for that last credit to post, like, okay, there's not 30 more programming days for him to get another 15 days, and then have to go in, back out the 628 that's in there, and dump a new one in.
Wow.
Kind of a challenge. The upside for these guys is while the 628 still needs updated for the manual release, it's still allowing the home confinement date to move. So you're getting there. Initially, that wasn't the case. Initially, you had to update the 628 in order for the home confinement.
Oh, wow.
Right. That part of it, they've adjusted. So now you RDAP guys go out there, and even though everything like looks stationary and not moving, right, in terms of the public website, the time credits are being applied each month, and the home confinement eligibility date is moving. So they get to go to home confinement. So that part's been taken care of. But it's just, they've got a manual process to take care of it right now. I know the guys that work in that office, and they are like praying for the day it's automated. So.
And the guys that retained me, this is while you were still working, but they'd retain me. You know, we'd send those requests up to folks in your area and whatnot and say, hey, here's what's going on. And these guys had already finished the 4 months. They're sitting there in the Halfway House, you know, with time, if you will, time to spare, not really, but you know, and so that's
right.
Like, hey, let's move this. And then sure enough, once it hit it, these would be immediate releases.
Right. And those were a lot of the kind of the process hiccups that were worked out early on. I mean, and it's not surprising, you know, we've talked about the complexity of the law, and that's required a very complex application, and things don't get thought about. Like, oh, it's just going to automatically move. Well, no, it didn't, because it's a paper operation and it didn't automatically move before. And you can, you know, test through different scenarios and see how they're going to work or not work. And yeah. And you're just trying to work it through. You know, one of the things that working on before I left was education, GED. So a little bit of backstory. When the VICLA, Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994 was passed, it added in a requirement regarding completion of GED status. And back then it was for violent offenders. And then 2 years later in 1996, they passed the Prison Litigation Reform Act. And everybody who has been sentenced since the passage, April 6th, I think, weirdly enough, I remember that. I think it was April 6th of 1996, has been sentenced under the Prison Litigation Reform Act. And what does that do? If you don't have a high school diploma and you're not working toward it and, you know, making satisfactory progress, instead of earning 54 days a year of statutory good conduct time, you only earn 42 days. And the way the law has been written is you can't decline it. You can't say, I'm not going to do it. The Bureau and the Bureau allow you to. So what happens if someone, you know, kind of comes in with a kind of knucklehead attitude about, I'm not going back to school, you can't make me, they get written an incident report. And after two or three incident reports, kind of the incident reports are the, hey, no, really, you need to go to school. after two or three incident reports, you are expelled. And when you are expelled, you go to fail and unsat, and you only get 42 days. Well, now 20 years goes by, not quite. Actually, yeah, 20 years goes by, and we pass the First Step Act. Education, GED status, is a need area. So you can meet the minimum standards under the PLRA status, right? So that you're not getting 42 days and you're getting your 54 days, but still not be compliant with FSA, because FSA doesn't give you an option to do 240 hours and drop out. You got to stay in it and finish it. So there's these two different, again, going back to laws saying two different things. This law says you have to have your minimum of 240 hours of satisfactory progress. And then, you know, you've got some latitude. Versus this law that says, no, finish your high school diploma, get your GED. And the coding is different. So they had to establish some unique coding in the 90s, because an individual would be, their status would be GED enrolled while they were on the wait list. Because it's, again, it's not their fault they're not in a classroom if they're on a wait list to get into the class, right?
Right.
So we can't penalize them and say, well, you're not in class, so you're getting 42 days. So they created this kind of GED enrolled status, which meant you agreed to participate, right? But you only are required to do 240 hours under that program. So you get to 240 hours. You've successfully done 240 hours. You have made the attempt. Now what? Oh, I can drop out now. I can stop going. Not under FSA. You got to finish it. Unless you have, you know, a documented learning disability that, you know, there are some exemptions, you know, if you have, you know, some extenuating circumstances that realistically you're not going to complete it. And an exemption, then you're not penalized. But like most of the population, that's like a little percent of the population that gets an exemption. So then they had to kind of figure out, like, with the existing codes, do we need new codes? Do we need more codes? Do we use these codes? How do we, you know, and that's messy. Another thing, under that same Prison Litigation Reform Act, non-U.S. citizens who are going to be deported not necessarily have a final order. They're like an illegal reentry person. They're exempt from the requirement of the 240 hours. But there is that they're not exempt under FSA, and not all illegal reentry cases are ineligible. The actual statute for illegal reentry has like an A and a B paragraph. One group is eligible and one group is ineligible. So you could even be prosecuted and convicted under illegal reentry after deportation. It's a small fraction of the cases, but you can, and then still be eligible for time credits. And you don't have a high school diploma, so you need to go to school, even though you're exempt from high school GED over on the, under this law. That's the challenge, is those different laws. Makes your head spin.
I know, man. It's just
crazy. Kind of crazy. So I was thinking, you know, I think there's some questions out there, you know, about just like, how do we get to earning credit? Like, that's the big question. You know, if you're heading in the direction of have a federal sentence, or you've just gotten there and you're a family member and you're trying to understand, like, how does this all work? Like, when I walk into prison, what do I got to do to get time credits? And that's an important question. We hear it all the time. Like, what do I got to do? And you know, the first thing is that conviction. And there's not a whole lot you can do with it. Once you're convicted, it's yours. So there's not a whole lot of changing that, although we have seen cases particularly on multi-count indictments, where the individual has gone back to court and had one of those charges thrown out, and that was the one that was making them ineligible. Had a case, individual had seven counts, and six of them were eligible, and the seventh one was a 924C. Okay. Went back to court, got that 924C thrown out. Apparently, it was kind of redundant for the other, based on the other convictions. Got that 924C thrown out. As soon as he was updated, that eligibility status changed. We were forcing time credits because he was an immediate release.
Yep.
And it was because something changed, which is goes back to why do we have to run through the entire population every single month, because things change. So other than the conviction, which for now, let's say that's said and done, right? When an individual arrives at the institution, they've got those self-assessments. And we've talked about them. They're on their computer access, the TruLink system. It's actually two surveys that cover four assessments. The one change this past year, initially, that was what delayed an individual from starting to earn. So if they got computer access today and they went in, they did all four surveys, great. But if they didn't go in and take care of it until next week, then they lost 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 days of programming days. The Bureau made the decision this last year, late last year, to give everybody 28 days.
That's right.
And so it kind of takes a little bit of pressure off, especially, you know, those first couple of days, you're doing a lot of things. You've got appointments. You're trying to get acclimated. You're in prison. You're adjusting. You don't have to be rushing to jump on the computer to get those assessments done. You've got that orientation period to get those four assessments done, which is great.
Did we have a case where somebody approached psychology and then they fixed it and they got...
That was a fifth assessment. So there are 13 assessments. That's why they call it the Spark 13, right? It's actually 13 assessment areas. Most of them, half of them, a little over half of them, are record reviews that are completed by staff. So the individual person, there's nothing he can do. You know, education staff is checking his GED status, right? The unit team is reviewing the judgment and commitment order and his PSR in terms of his initial drug history status, right? He's not or she's not directly involved with that. It's a record review by staff. There's the four assessments on the computer, the surveys. They have to do those 100%. Don't skip any questions. Then there's two others that the individual is involved in. First one is trauma. The trauma assessment, and this is where the confusion can happen. Unlike the other self-assessments that here's this thing and I got to open it up and I got to answer all the questions. That's easy peasy. The trauma assessment is part of the initial intake process. So when an individual is sitting in R&D, receiving a discharge, they've just gotten there, whether it's by bus or a voluntary surrender, they're sitting there, they're given a stack of papers. And they have to complete everything. And there's everything from notices around mail and legal mail and next of kin and all these things. If one of the piece of paper is a psychology intake screening form, screening questionnaire, it's not even called a form. It's called the psychology intake screening questionnaire. And it's got, I don't know, 30, 35 questions, 40 questions. It's duplex front and back. And you got to answer all of them. And there's 6 or 8 questions in there that serve as the trauma assessment. Mm. So you get the stack of paper, you fill it all out, you turn it back into the staff member, right, who's working and receiving and discharge. They go through that stack of paper, and these pieces of paper go to the unit team, and this paper goes to psychology, and this paperwork goes to medical, and they divide it all out. This goes over to the records office. Bob's your uncle, goes to the departments, gets processed, uploaded. That's wonderful. Except if the piece of paper isn't in the stack. And that's what happened with one of our clients is the piece of paper, whoever was collating, that one it missed, right? And because it missed, he didn't do it because he didn't know it was there.
Wow.
And you don't see that happen often. It was a fluke. We have changed how we do our intake orientations for our clients that retain us before they come to prison. We're like, look for the piece of paper. Because it is unusual that it got missed. So then when all the stacks were divvied out, psychology didn't get a piece of paper for him. We found out about it, got a hold of the family, tell him to go to psychology today. So he went to psychology. Sure enough, psychology didn't have a form for him and had him sit down and he filled it all out and turned it back in. And instead of giving him credit, arguably they should have given him credit to when he walked in the door.
Right. He backed up.
That's where the paper should have been. They gave him paperwork for the day he completed it. And he's working through that now. And we've been kind of coaching him on that administrative remedy process to point out, like, it was an error and things happen, errors happen. We're still dealing with human beings, but he really legitimately should get credit.
Right.
Back to when he would have done it. He didn't actually refuse to do it. He didn't get the paperwork to do it. And like I said, it's a mistake. It didn't have to be an administrative remedy.
No, it's an interesting case, right? Because the guy now is trying to get the time he deserves from the day.
And it was about 65, 70, it was right over 60 days. I can't remember exactly programming days. And those are important days. That's 20 time credits, you know?
Yeah.
We want to see that happen. And hopefully we see some positive, fingers crossed, some positive results soon. Otherwise, if it doesn't get corrected at the institution level, we'll kind of help them, we'll give them a little guided direction on how to do the administrative remedies to the BP-10, to the region. And, I'll throw in now, whenever someone's doing administrative remedies, never give up at the 9 level. The important part about the regional level is, unlike at the institution level, you know, at the regional level, it's being reviewed by a subject matter expert. So in the case of FSA, it's going to be reviewed by correctional programs folks, but it's also reviewed by the legal folks. And legal is going to ask those questions because they're looking at, all right, we're at the 10 level, then there's been, then it goes out to court. Is the decision we're making legally defensible?
Right.
And that's why legal gets involved. So that regional administrative level is so important because of how the two-step process of both the subject matter expert and the legal folks taking a look at it.
That is a great tip, because oftentimes folks will stop at the administrative level or at the institution level.
Well, the warden said no.
Right. But it is. But also, you know, you have multiple sets of eyes denying it as well. And so that written, whatever their response is very interesting to see what.
And it's important to understand the warden, when he or she is getting a BP-9 response, they're relying on the knowledge and expertise of their people.
Yeah.
And you know, everybody was new once. And is the department head a new department head? Is he or she an experienced department head? Is the case manager that's looking at it, are they new? Are they experienced? So can a warden get the information from the department head that's written up and given to him and it sound good and correct? And then they've given the warden bad information and the warden signs off and says, well, this seems all reasonable. Okay. Denied.
Right.
But if the warden got bad information, because not all of our wardens, you know, our wardens come, the Bureau's wardens come from all different disciplines, you know, they may not, they don't know the ins and outs of it. It's not their job to know the ins and outs.
Right.
That's why they have subject matter experts themselves.
Right. Absolutely.
So, But going back to that initial process, so, you know, we've got the intake process, we've got those assessments. Oh, I forgot. There's the one other assessment that the individual has a role in, may have a role in, is the dyslexia screening. Education does a preliminary screening, and if it appears that there may be some issues related to dyslexia, then the individual will be scheduled with education to come down, do some additional testing, and if they can choose to decline that, but if they do, that's where they're refusing. That's where they're kicking themselves out of time credit eligibility. Yeah. So they, you know, we talk about it all the time about if the team tells you to do something, do it. And that's the next part of the time credits, right? So you've done your role, you've done quickly the assessments you're supposed to do, you've done what you're supposed to do. Now you're at team, and the unit team is looking at the information that's come in so far, and they're making recommendations. You got some substance abuse issues, judge wanted you to participate in substance abuse treatment. We're going to recommend drug education. They may go ahead and recommend both drug education and non-residential treatment to follow, or residential treatment to follow. Or they may just recommend drug education. If they recommend drug education, then that's what you do next. If they recommend drug education and followed by non-res, then we go to drug education and then sign up for non-res. Like, we want to do, because once you step out of that recommendation,
right.
I have a problem.
Right.
I went to a drug treatment program before I came into prison. That's beautiful. But the judge said, and based on that judicial recommendation, you need to do this.
It's important to participate in programming that's relevant to the assessment. You may take some classes. They might not count. So you want to make sure that you do take things that are recommended. You know, even if it says parenting and your parents are, or your kids are old, if it says financial stuff, then, you know, and you're a multimillionaire. If it says antisocial peers, but you're a loner, I mean, you know, you're going to have to.
Absolutely. Right? It's about compliance. And that's really what successful participation in programming is. Do you have a need? Is it an EBBR or productive activity? Were you assigned to it by staff? It's not if this isn't an a la carte menu, you don't get to pick and choose what you want to do. The way the law is written is you have been assigned to it by staff based on your need. And we see that. We see folks trying to like gobble up programming because they think that's all they have to do.
Right.
And they don't realize that this is connected. This is all linked together. Need programming. And if there's not a need, not saying taking financial literacy classes isn't a good thing, but if you don't have a finance poverty need, then those classes are good, but they're not connected to FSA.
Right.
And that's that important linkage. You know, maybe another show we can talk about pattern, because we know that the pattern programming for pattern is the recidivism risk assessment. The programming for pattern and the programming time credit programming, there's overlap, but it's not necessarily the same thing. There are some self-assessment classes that you can do that you can sign up for and get credit toward your pattern to improve your risk level that you can do independently. And you don't have to be assigned to it by staff, but that's for your pattern risk assessment. Time credits are a different animal.
Right. We've had people go from medium to low or whatever. And then they think, hey, if I take this class, or does it credit me days? And no, that's not how it works. But
right. And it's just, it's the way because the pattern risk assessment is different. And I expect to see in the coming years, more programming be added to the pattern risk assessment tool. In fact, in the last validation report, they actually talked about the fact that the next cohort of cases that they use for the validation and modeling are individuals that actually were assessed under pattern. Up until now, they've been taking folks that kind of came into the agency and released prior to FSA, and they were just taking the data that was available and kind of creating a pattern model as if they had gone through pattern, versus this next cohort will actually be folks who were risk assessed under the pattern model. And that's kind of, like I said, they were retrospective, and it has to do with the fact of how recidivism research is done. Like, right, the person gets released and you got to wait 3 years and then look back. Did they recidivate? And so that's how that works. So
was probation doing their own version of pattern? And
not pattern. I don't remember I don't recall the name.
It was some kind of a risk thing that they were risk maybe. Yeah,
absolutely. And years ago, the district, one of the Missouri districts, was very, very, very active in that. And like I said, this was a number of years ago. But they looked at these risk models and these risk assessments to look at the level of supervision that you needed. What level of intensity in terms of supervision? Could you do a once a month check-in, or did you need to be seen once a week? You know, kind of thing. And that was how they assessed what was the level of intensity of your supervision requirements,
right,
based on your risk level. And we're seeing that in different places. I recently was in a presentation, State of Ohio. That's what they're looking at. They're looking at their low risk offenders, and not having them on the same level of supervision. I mean, they have their 3 years or whatever it is, but they're focusing their supervision energy, so to speak, the resources of those parole officers and probation officers on the high risk cases. And they're not getting any wiggle room. They, you know, you're a high risk case. You're a gang member involved in violence and you've been released and you get picked up 2 weeks after release with a gun, you're going back to prison, because they're keeping really tight ties on those individuals. And the low risk, the nonviolent, this folks over here that, you know, don't have a lengthy history, they got themselves in trouble, maybe theft, maybe burglaries, those kind of things. They're on supervision, but they're not at that intensity level, because they understand that these folks have a lower risk to get in trouble again versus these folks over here. And they're seeing results pay off in the state of Ohio. Really kind of interesting research out there. And I'm kind of a geek when it comes to research, but some really interesting research. But at the federal level, Congress in the previous Congress, the 23-24 year, both the Senate and the House introduced the Safer Supervision Act. And what that act will allow is give the judges more discretion in terms of these lower risk individuals being allowed to not necessarily need a lengthy supervision. You know, we may start to see cases where you get 12 months of supervision as opposed to 3 to 5 years is pretty standard. 3 years is you got to be pretty bad to get to five, but like pretty standard 3 years of supervised release, even for super short. I mean, we've seen how many cases have we seen where their supervision is longer than their incarceration. And this Safer Supervision Act is again about focusing the resources of federal probation on the folks that are the high risk folks. And it's really, it's a smart strategy.
Because the probation caseloads are theoretically high, and they need, and if they can use these empirical validated measures, the risk need responsive, R&R, risk needs responsivity is a model, and there's others that are kind of variations of that theme. Mm-hmm. To allocate supervision resources, like you said, you know, and I've seen a couple of cases that just got a year of supervision. I mean, their sentence was super short or whatever, and they did the supervision so they could get the FSA. You know,
absolutely.
What I mean?
Kind of, which is something we've talked about in terms of why is there supervision requirement attached to getting the time credits? Why did they write it that way? Now they're looking at the Safer Supervision Act, which will allow the judge's discretion to say, you know what? Okay, you screwed up and you've been convicted and you're going to have some time, but you're a really low risk. We're not going to have any supervision at all. Now those folks, which is a good decision in terms of the evidence and related to supervision and the need for supervision, but now these folks aren't going to get time credits applied to early release because the FSA attached, instead of having it being advancing their release date, it advanced their transfer to supervised release. And that's been one of the recommendations that you and I have been putting out publicly, that they really need to go back and amend that and just take that out, because it doesn't make sense in the context of this new legislation that's kind of working its way, and it's got bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate.
So we'll definitely see what happens, and that makes sense to me because the judges and the judicial branch have control of the probation officers, and they set the tone with probation and how long and who the officers are and what level that they're on. So I think that's a nice segue, you know, early on, if possible, when you know, in the judgment commitment order, and they're just reduced, you know, just, and, you know, they specify the time of supervised release to follow. And again, it's not our business. We're BOP people, right? But it is interesting how we're kind of sandwiched in the middle. You know, it starts and it ends with the judicial branch. So it is very, very interesting to see that nuance.
And just the idea, and I know I just looked at the clock, we're running out of time, but how much better would it be for folks going through the criminal justice system if there was better continuity of information flow? You know, there's a pretrial information thing, and then you come into the Bureau, and the Bureau manually is entering information into the Bureau's computer system. And then you finish your sentence and sends information out to probation in PDF form. And then they get it and they're manually re-entering information. It seems like we really, in 2025, have some technology where that information from the court, from the judgment and commitment order and the PSR can flow directly electronically.
Seamlessly
from probation through the Bureau and back out to probation.
No, that's real interesting. And the criteria is, if this person is low risk in supervision, did the BOP see them as low risk at that same level of risk in their incarceration, or was there something that was, there was a domestic violence back when the person was 17 years old, etc. So,
and the level of really moving the research forward would be phenomenal. I'm going to break right there. We ended last week's show with a trivia question.
Okay.
And we're going to put a link in the comment section for those. So the answer is the 1980 Winter Olympics at Lake Placid, New York, is now FCI Rabra. And that was a planned thing. And the article, actually, the link that we'll put in the comments section actually talks about a little bit of history of how that happened. But yes, the housing units that now house the individuals incarcerated at FCI Raybrook were the athletes' dormitories back in the day. So kind of interesting little thing. Bruce, do you want to talk about the books?
We have a couple of seconds here.
Not paying attention. What am I going to do?
Here we go. Your FSA book here, Unlocking Federal Time Credits. This is for classification, right? If you're pre-sentence, pre-trial or whatever, and while you're in. So please get those. So great. Well, it's another fantastic show today. Thank you so much for tuning in. I think we're going to be on
the podcast. If you have questions, put them in the chat. Always. Yeah, and if there's topics you're interested in, put those in the chat. We want to make this meaningful to everybody.
Right. You can put those in the YouTube chat. Once this gets posted on YouTube, you can go to our Facebook group First Step Act, early release from federal prison, and that's a wonderful resource there too. So thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great week, and we'll see you here next time on Around the Block. Take care, everybody.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.